You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up at 7, it's Latino USA. This week, they talk about what makes a sanctuary for LGBT people of color, from the safety and freedom of gay clubs to Latino USA listeners sharing stories about LGBT gyms and choral groups. That's tonight at 7 o'clock on Latino USA.
First, a look at the three U.S. Supreme Court decisions announced yesterday. The High Court overturned a Texas law that required abortion providers to have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles. Justices also upheld restrictions that prevent individuals convicted of misdemeanor counts of domestic violence from owning a gun. And in another ruling, the Supreme Court made it harder to prosecute public officials for corruption, overturning the conviction of Bob McDonnell, former governor of Virginia. We'll talk to Barbara Perry from the University of Virginia about those decisions in just a few minutes.
But first, Julaine Appling is with us. Yesterday, we spoke to a guest from the National Women's Law Center about the Supreme Court's ruling on the Texas abortion law. And now we're getting another perspective on that case. Julaine Appling is president of Wisconsin's Family Action. Julaine, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Veronica. Thank you for the opportunity.
So, Julaine, what was your first reaction when you heard the news yesterday of that Supreme Court decision on the Texas abortion law?
Well, to be honest with you, with this court right now, I'm not surprised any longer with these kinds of rulings, but of course I am disappointed. I continue to be pretty much an eternal optimist, and I hope that the court will understand that states have the right to determine laws for the well-being of women and to make appropriate laws related to abortion. And I believe the court got this one very wrong.
And, of course, today the court rejected appeals from Wisconsin and from Mississippi over laws that would require abortion providers to have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital. That appeal rejected today. Did that news surprise you?
No, it doesn't surprise me, because the major part of the Texas case, and I'm pretty sure Wisconsin also filed an amicus brief on that Texas case, by the way, Veronica. Mm-hmm. But a part of that was the being requiring the doctors who do abortions have admitting privileges to hospitals within a 30-mile radius of where the abortions are being performed. And so when they struck down that law for Texas, I couldn't see a path for them to be willing to take the case that Attorney General Schimmel was involved with here in Wisconsin. So I'm not surprised. Look, we passed those laws 2 or 3 years ago in Wisconsin. Our organization worked hard to do it, because we believe that we need to give women the very best opportunity to protect their safety and their well-being. Abortion is not a procedure that is without risk. And I don't have a report in front of me because I'm on the road right now, but I know that there are thousands of women who have abortions who have complications. And of those, there is a 10% of those that end up in the needing hospitalization. Look, you know, we want to make sure that a woman who's in that situation in Wisconsin, her doctor, her abortionist can get her into a hospital and get her admitted to get the proper care. I tell you, this is just yet another example of the federal government encroaching on the right of states to make laws that are reasonable and respectful and helpful for the well-being of women.
Now that we have this ruling from the Supreme Court, what's next for groups like yours, for Wisconsin Family Action, when it comes to abortion?
Well, that's a good question, because while we suffered this defeat with the High Court, it certainly does not deter us from doing everything we can to protect unborn children as well as the women who are carrying those children. And so, as the new legislative session gears up in the beginning of next year, we'll take a close look at what we think needs to be done to ensure that, well, women who are thinking about abortion get the information they need to make an informed decision, and that should they decide to go ahead with that, that their well-being, their safety, their health is of primary importance.
Julaine, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for the opportunity.
That was Julaine Appling, president of Wisconsin Family Action. Now, Barbara Perry joins us here on Central Time for analysis of the three U.S. Supreme Court decisions announced yesterday, one overturning the Texas abortion law, another that upholds restriction on gun ownership for those convicted of misdemeanor counts of domestic violence, and a third that overturned the conviction of Virginia's former governor, Bob McDonnell. Barbara Perry is a professor of ethics and institutions and director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. Barbara, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be with you, Veronica.
Well, let's start with the latest on that Supreme Court ruling on the Texas abortion law. Now, the court has already rejected appeals from Wisconsin and Mississippi over similar laws, like the one that was being enacted here in Wisconsin, as we said. What about similar laws where there hasn't been a court challenge yet? Do you see anything else coming down the pike?
Well, it's possible that those who would be against such laws would say, well, sure, let's go ahead and just play this out. Let's take a challenge to such laws, and we'll work our way through the federal system. And as we do so, from the very first, even at a U.S. district court, the thing about a Supreme Court decision that's decided by a majority, and this case, of course, was 5-3, once that happens, then the U.S. Supreme Court has set the precedent for all of the lower federal courts. So it is now the case that the lower federal court judges would have to apply the law as written and announced yesterday by the Supreme Court. So that's why your previous guest, of course, was concerned and understandably disappointed by the court's ruling, because it means that that strategy of those who oppose access to abortion, of trying to work through the clinic side of it and the provision side of it, the doctor side of it, we'll have to determine a different strategy, a different political and legal strategy.
One provision of the Wisconsin law was to require an ultrasound before an abortion could be obtained. Do you see provisions like that particular one coming any sort of legal challenge?
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting one. That's more like the case that people know as the Casey case, the Planned Parenthood versus Casey, than the governor of Pennsylvania. That came down 25 years ago with Justice O'Connor writing a joint opinion for herself and several others of the justices. And she developed what people might have heard yesterday as this case came down from the current court, the so-called undue burden test. And that was to look at both the kinds of limitations or requirements that would be placed on clinics, but also on women seeking abortions. And it was a little bit different from the old Roe versus Wade trimester approach that the court had used. In this instance, in 25 years ago, Justice O'Connor created this undue burden test. And it measures, in looking at every kind of either restriction or regulation placed on a clinic or placed on a woman seeking an abortion, whether that state limitation or state restriction causes what she said would be an undue burden to a woman seeking an abortion. And I always would point that out in the classroom to students, the term a woman. You know, if even one woman is burdened by these laws, then using that test, the court would say that the law was unconstitutional. And so that's where the kind of ultrasound requirement, or there were issues over the years of a 24-hour waiting period for a woman, or a requirement in Pennsylvania that she would have to consult with and get the consent of her partner. That's how the court, through Justice O'Connor's undue burden test, would measure whether that could be a constitutional or an unconstitutional limitation on a woman's right to seek an abortion.
Do you have a better sense of the parameters of the undue burden test now that we have some ideas what it applies to so far, like admitting privileges?
Yes, because what the court was saying, I think, in yesterday's decision, by virtue of that Texas law, which had then resulted in the closure of, as I understand it, about half of the state's abortion provider clinics, would indicate to the court that now an undue burden was going to be placed on a woman trying to seek an abortion in Texas, such a large state geographically and with fewer options to go to. I think it went from 40-some-odd clinics down to about 19. That very concept could be viewed as posing an undue burden for a woman seeking an abortion in Texas.
Now, looking now at about how all this could affect the presidential race taking place right now leading up to the fall, candidate Donald Trump has announced that he is pro-life. Hillary Clinton says she is pro-choice. How do you expect this particular debate and decision to affect the race?
Well, it will be fascinating, won't it, that you have two diametrically opposed positions that each of these presumptive candidates has staked out. And oftentimes voters will say, or I would certainly hear students say in the classroom, oh, there's not a dime's worth of difference between the two candidates. I just think they're all politicians are alike, and then there's some negative stereotype of a politician. And in this instance, people can't say that about Mrs. Clinton or Mr. Trump. They have staked out very different positions. Mrs. Clinton has certainly been a pro-choice, pro-abortion advocate for many, many years as a feminist. And Donald Trump, I would be hard-pressed to say, you know, over the scope of his life or his public life, because he hasn't been a politician for very long, it's hard to say, but famously in an interview with Chris Matthews, he allowed that he thought women seeking an abortion should face civil or criminal punishment for it, which was quite a statement to make.
We're talking to Barbara Perry right now from the University of Virginia's Miller Center, talking about three U.S. Supreme Court rulings released yesterday.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How do you think these Supreme Court rulings will play in the presidential race this fall and the empty seat on the Supreme Court? The ability to appoint that next Supreme Court justice, is that something that will affect the vote? Will it affect your vote in November? And a lot of people vote because of their feelings on abortion. This ruling out, do you think this is something that will sway the way you vote? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation and get to your calls in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're picking up our discussion now with Barbara Perry from the University of Virginia about the U.S. Supreme Court rulings released yesterday.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have an opinion on those rulings released yesterday? And is this something you're watching closely? The U.S. Supreme Court, the empty seat on that U.S. Supreme Court, possible openings coming up as we head toward the presidential race. Is this something motivating you to vote for a candidate? Maybe to vote for a candidate that otherwise you're not that excited about. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Barbara, if you look back a decade or two, there was a lot of attention paid to the single-issue voter, and a lot of the times that single-issue voter was one who voted based on a candidate's position on abortion. Now, do you see that this ruling, this decision from the U.S. Supreme Court, could reignite, I mean, it hasn't ever really gone away, but could reignite that same sort of phenomenon now to a greater extent?
Of course, there are still many one-issue voters. Hard to know exactly how many, but there certainly are some, and it depends on the issue. So for some people, it's guns, and for some people, it's religious issues, and this may be a religious issue for many people. So for some, it'll be a women's rights issue. I have a colleague here at the University of Virginia who, very renowned constitutional scholar, and for him, it was affirmative action because he had grown up a Jewish German lad in Hitler's Germany and had to run for his life from the Nazis because of his religion. So he never wanted religion or race or gender or ethnicity to be used in any kind of employment or academic decision-making process. So it depends on people's backgrounds, and it could be that they are one-issue voters. And abortion, because it's so obviously viewed by many as a matter of life and death, it is something that creates a great deal of emotion, and I suspect that this ruling yesterday will not only continue for those who believe that's the one issue that they want to pick their candidate on, will also have an impact on how people are viewing that open seat of the late Justice Scalia on the bench.
Well, I want to talk more about that, but first, let's get to some of the other rulings. One of them yesterday upheld restrictions preventing those convicted of misdemeanor counts of domestic violence from owning a gun. Tell us more about that decision and that case.
Right. So the question was whether someone who had been convicted under a state law of a misdemeanor and a domestic abuse, on specifically whether that assault conviction for what they called reckless conduct could trigger this prohibition in the federal law of not being allowed to purchase or own a firearm. And the court decided yes, and took sort of the gun control position on it in a 6-2 decision. that indeed these state laws, state convictions, could be used in the federal under the federal statute to prohibit those who had been accused and convicted of domestic violence from obtaining a firearm.
And the word reckless played a role here. Tell us about that word.
Well, it did. And this was part of the issue that, the person who had had this misdemeanor conviction on his record and was being denied access to a gun had said that there was a difference, and in fact the law recognized a difference between a reckless push, let's say, or as Justice Thomas in dissent said, you know, what if somebody just swings a baseball bat and they don't really mean to hit anybody but they accidentally do? Well, you could say they didn't intend to hit anybody but they recklessly swung the bat and so they hit their domestic partner. He was trying to draw a distinction between those two acts and the intention behind them. A reckless instance, not intentional. Intentional, obviously intentional. And the court in the majority did not go along with that in a 6-2 case, 6-2 decision with Justice Kagan writing for the liberals on the bench. Although, interestingly enough, she was also joined by more conservative justices, Alito and Chief Justice Roberts, and Justice Sotomayor, usually pretty reliably in the liberal camp and you would think of as a feminist, she joined in dissent with Justice Thomas on this this ground of trying to determine the difference between reckless and intentional acts of violence against a domestic partner. The dissenters saw a difference between them. The majority did not.
And it sounds like this case, early on especially, got a little extra attention because of Justice Clarence Thomas. Tell us what happened.
Yes. Well, it's hard in some ways to believe, especially someone like myself who follows the court closely over the years and been to many, many oral arguments, but he's well known for not speaking during oral arguments. And in fact, he had gone an entire decade without asking a question. And finally, after a decade, he asked a question in this case. And it was asking about this issue of the Second Amendment, a constitutional right to own and bear arms, and how that would relate to somebody being given a lifetime ban of having access to a firearm. And he thought that this was, and stated so, thought this was the only instance of a constitutional right that was being denied to someone on a lifetime basis because of, in this case, a simply reckless act of domestic violence.
We're talking to the University of Virginia's Miller Center, Barbara Perry, right now, talking about recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions. And the third we want to get to today is a ruling that some say could make it more difficult to prosecute public officials for corruption. This relates to the case of Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell. Barbara, set that up for us. What was the case centered around?
Well, as you can imagine, those of us here in the Old Dominion were watching this one carefully. Our former governor, after he had left office, and along with his wife, were tried for public corruption because they had accepted up to $175,000 worth of loans, money, gifts, Rolex watches, trips, vacations, partial payment of their daughter's wedding reception from a man who was peddling an elixir, I will call it, a tobacco-based elixir, a health supplement that, I should put it more neutrally, a health supplement that he wanted the governor to help him peddle by giving him introductions to people in state government. He actually wanted Virginia State Universities to do health studies about this. Now, he never got that far, but Governor McDonnell had set up meetings for him with state officials, had had meetings and lunches at which this man was able to present the view, his view about this elixir to people or this health supplement at lunches at the Capitol. And so the prosecution, this was a federal statute that was said to be violated as a bribery situation, so that this man with his health supplement giving all this money to the governor and his wife had then curried favor with the governor and his wife. That was the application of the federal law that was viewed as official acts. that had been done in return for this money and these many opportunities that had been given the governor.
And what did the Supreme Court say?
And the Supreme Court said that the lower federal courts had given too broad a definition to public or official acts. The Chief Justice, in writing this, we should note, for a unanimous court, 8-0, really tightened the definition of a public act to say that in order to see a corruption, you'd have to see the money or the gifts coming in to a public official, and then a specific public act, an official act of signing a law, for example, or creating, in this instance, the governor, if he had created or ordered the state university to do tests on this elixir. And absent that, the court was saying that what the governor did not fall under the official acts component of this federal bribery statute. And so, in effect, then, his conviction was overturned and sent back then to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals here in Virginia to decide whether under this narrower definition of official act that there should be a new trial of the former governor.
And we leave it there. Barbara, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're so welcome, Veronica. Thank you.
That was Barbara Perry, Professor of Ethics and Institutions and Director of Presidential Studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. And she joined us there to break down those three recent U.S. Supreme Court rulings that were just announced yesterday.